Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
The best-selling author Jojo Moyes was a writer long before Me Before You took off and made her a household name. She also wrote the screenplay for the movie that followed it. And then she changed tack with The Giver of Stars, a book about women librarians in rural Kentucky in the 1930s. But we're firmly back in the now with her new book, Someone Else's Shoes. Jojo Moyes, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's lovely to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on the programme. And I don't know about you, but I really appreciate an early night. And this book did not help me because it is an absolute page turner. It grabs you and won't let you go. Was that your intention?
Oh, well, that's the loveliest thing to hear. So thank you very much. I mean, that's what we want, but you can never guarantee that it's going to happen.
It starts with a bang with these two characters with very different lives, and those lives connect in a sort of a sliding doors moment. And that contrast, was that something that you wanted in there from the get-go, the completely
yes.
different way of living?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a middle-aged woman, and I was sort of intrigued by the way different women's lives end up at this age. And in one, you have a character who's very wealthy but quite angry, and she turns all her anger outwards. And the other one is what we call the squeezed middle, you know, the one who's pressured by family concerns, elderly parents, daughter, depressed husband, a boss at work. And she's having a very different experience of it. And it's what happens when those two women accidentally swap gym bags at a crisis point in both their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I'd have a bit of fun with it.
And you certainly did. And Anisha, who's the woman who has this fabulously wealthy life on the outside, it's not so fabulous once you scratch the surface. But what I loved about her was the way how hard she fell, and she had to really quickly adapt, and she became a cleaner in a hotel. You know, one thing that's stood out for me was how quickly she started smoking. And I think that looking at her life before, the little hints and glimpses we got of her life, that she would never have put a cigarette near her mouth for the previous 15 years. But suddenly life became really, really tough, and she needed something to look forward to.
Absolutely. And, you know, as someone, I had a lot of personal change during the pandemic. And then, of course, we had a pandemic. And what I realized is that, you know, you think your life is set in stone at one point, and then everything can get blown away and you can have to change everything and reassess who you are. And I think both these women have to do that with some, you know, perhaps questionable habits on the way.
Mm-hmm. Your life changed a lot, didn't it? Your marriage came to an amicable end, but that's a huge
yeah.
moment in anybody's life. Was that the genesis for this book?
I never know if it is, but then often I look back on books a few years later and I realize that what I was doing was writing free therapy, I think. Yeah, my own life changed dramatically. My mother had been very ill with cancer and she died after 4 years, and my marriage of 22 years ended. And so suddenly I had to kind of reassess all sorts of things about how I was in the world. And I'm sure a lot of that fed into this book.
Sam, then, who was our squeezed middle character.
Mm.
She's quite good at friendship. She has a friendship that has lasted for her entire life, and that's there from the beginning and right through to the end. Nisha, who had all the money, she's not good at friends.
No, because she's one of those women who doesn't really trust other women, partly because of the position she's in. But what I wanted to show was, you know, I think if you can look beyond what you think you don't have in common with somebody. I think most women, and in fact, most people, once they get to their 40s and 50s, they're survivors of something. And I usually find that I can find something in common with everybody at this age, because we've all been through it. Everybody's been through it. If, mm-hmm. you know, if you're lucky enough even to still be here. So I wanted to show how those women could find common ground, even though they came from very different parts of the world.
The shoes are, they're a main character as well. The shoes that are very, very difficult to walk in.
Yes. I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, since the last few years, I've just become a trainer's person or clumpy boots, and I walk everywhere. But I do love a pair of high heels occasionally. I just think it makes you stand differently. It makes you behave slightly differently. It's, you know, it's the power of clothing. My grandmother used to say to me, you know, if you're feeling down, you put on a nice red lipstick and, you know, just go out and face the world. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something in that about how we present ourselves. Sometimes it can kind of of change how we behave and how we feel inside.
Yeah, and I don't assume that people know what we're talking about, because obviously you've written the book and I've read it, but the shoes are left in the gym bag. So they were Nisha's shoes, these fabulous Louboutin shoes, and they end up in Sam's possession, and off we go from there.
Off we go.
I mean, you've said that you're a trainers and clumpy boots person now, but you still love the high heel shoes. I think many people after the pandemic are kind of over the heels completely and never want to go back.
Well, I've been lucky enough never have to wear heels for work. You know, I think some people who work in offices or receptions, or, you know, they have to kind of adopt a certain way of dressing. So for me, it's just been fun. But also I find that, you know, because we've also spent so much time in flat shoes, it's much harder to put our feet into these things. And you start questioning them, going, why did I ever wear shoes that I can't run for a bus in, or, you know, even walk down the road in? Mm-hmm. But yeah, but it is still nice for a special occasion to look kind of glamorous, I guess.
It is. But for a short period of time. And then
very short period of time with a pair of trainers in a bag at the side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Sam's husband, I just wanted to talk to you about him, because I found it hard to like him. Even towards the end, I found it hard to like him. You just wanted to give him a good shake.
Yeah, he's depressed for the first part of the book. And at first, I wanted the reader to kind of feel a bit the way you do, which is that, come on, you know, get a grip, which is, I think, quite a common response to depression in men. You know, they're told to man up and, you know, be tough, just get on with it. And what interested me is, you know, peeling back the layers to discover why he is feeling the way he is and the burdens that he's carrying, and also his discomfort with discussing feelings at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of men who just don't want to go there. They just, you know, it's not something they've been brought up to do. But I think in the case of depression, it becomes absolutely vital.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because you look at her and what she's doing. She's trying to keep the family together. She's trying to keep the house, the roof over their heads, and do all of the work. And then she comes home and the dog is dying for a pee and nobody's taking the dog out. And her husband can't see any of that.
Well, I'm wondering if a few women will identify with that. You know, there is that thing, you know, it's like the loo roll fairy has obviously replaced the loo rolls up to this point. It's all that kind of thing, that the invisible work that a lot of women do. I'm not saying all men, before I get kind of lambasted for it, but I think more women will identify with that feeling than men, that, you know, there is just so much stuff that the family assumes gets done by itself.
Now, your writing life has changed a lot as well. I mean, I mentioned doing the screenplay for Me Before You.
Yes.
Has that changed how you write at all?
I think it has. I mean, I think I've always been a visual writer anyway. You know, some writers spent kind of days crafting a perfect sentence. I think I'm a storyteller, but I have to visualize things before I write them. You know, I actually play them through like kind of cinema scenes. And so it wasn't a big leap for me to move to screenplay. But it's made me a bit more disciplined in that, you know, when you write a screenplay, every word has to count, every action has to count, because you've only got limited time and space. And now I think I work a little bit harder not to, I don't know, noodle around on the page.
Yeah, and also
I'm better then.
I have found this working as a journalist previously for television. If you're a reporter on television, every word that you write, you sort of have to visualize it, or you have to be able to find a way that the viewer can see it. Is that in your mind?
Absolutely. And one of the things I found when I worked on the movie set of Me Before You was what an actor is doing, whether they're in motion, affects the way the words come across. So if you're watching like an action movie, frankly, half the time the script doesn't matter because you're busy watching the car flying through the air or the, you know, the man on fire in the corner. Whereas if, you know, in the case of Will Traynor, my character who was unable to move, if he can't move, then what comes out of his mouth becomes twice as important because the audience has nothing else to focus on. So, yeah, exactly that. Movement becomes a very important part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. You're working on a TV project now, although I'm not sure whether you can tell us too much about it.
Well, I'm working on a couple of things, but who knows whether they'll come to fruition. I'm working on a comedy show for Sky about midlife dating, not that I've been on any. And I'm also adapting someone else's shoes for TV in America. So, yeah, I've got a busy time ahead.
So already you're working on the adaptation?
Yeah, I actually sold the adaptation before I'd finished writing the book.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
That was interesting. I was doing the two things concurrently, which was new to me.
Is there a pressure to that?
There is, but I like it. I don't know. I feel so lucky. You know, you mentioned at the beginning that I was not a very successful writer for a long time before I was a successful writer. And I think I just really appreciate when anybody is interested in me doing anything. So I enjoy it.
I read an interview with you where you said you're not very good at not doing anything.
I'm not. I'm getting better at it. You know, I think what we've all been through in the last few years has forced a lot of people like me to just stop and sit with things. And I've definitely got a better work-life balance than I did. You know, I make sure I walk my dogs for at least an hour and a half every day. And that's a really valuable part of my day. Just, you know, meeting my best friend for a coffee and chatting. That was stuff I never built in time for before. And I think I've learned, you know, life is short and we've got to have some of the sweet stuff as well as, you know, working, I guess, if we're lucky.
You've mentioned your dogs. So you've got to tell us the story about your rescue dog.
Oh, yeah. Sisu. So I, after my last rescue dog was clearly coming to the end of her life, and in fact, when in my worst year, which was 2020, when everything was going, you know, horribly wrong, I saw a picture of the saddest dog I'd ever seen on the internet, and she had been in a Bosnian pound for 6 years. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to make sure one good thing happens this year. So I applied to adopt her. And the day after she arrived, my ex-husband thought he'd take her for a walk while I wasn't there, and she escaped and ran away for 10 days. And we had to track her. I employed a pet detective, and I bought, you know, cameras for night cameras for the local woodland, and the local farmers let me use their, you know, trees to put up the cameras. And I tracked her with the aid of barbecued sausages and sardine oil, and got her back after 10 days.
What was she doing? Where was she?
She was, a little fact for you, when dogs run away, they don't tend to run off in straight lines. They triangulate around the place that they've been because that makes them feel safer. So I knew as long as nobody chased her, she would stay within a few miles of my house. And she did. So it was really just trying to work out where she was eating and drinking, leaving out food and water. And we borrowed from a dog rescue charity an enormous crate trap, and you know, finally lured her in with some sausages overnight, and I came out at 5:30 one morning, and there she was.
Determination.
It was, but I just felt that having bought this poor dog all the way over, you know, I didn't want to make her life worse. And she's rewarded me tenfold. She's now my shadow, and you know, she's a dream. She's a very easy, calm, sweet-natured dog, and yeah, I feel lucky to have her.
Well, Jojo, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and we wish you every continued success. I look forward to seeing someone else's shoes now on TV when it eventually gets to that point. But for now, I'm going to recommend it to everyone because, as I said at the beginning, it's a real page turner. You will not be disappointed. It's out now. It's called Someone Else's Shoes by Jojo Moyes. Thank you, Jojo.
Thank you so much for having me, Claire.
You're so welcome. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.